Pull up a chair. It's early morning here on the field. The grass is still wet, the sun's just starting to burn the haze off the flight line, and if you walk far enough down into the antique rows past the round engine Wacos and the Cubs and the Stinsons, you get to the really old stuff. The airplanes with wings you could put your fist through wood and wire and dope linen. The airplanes that started all of it. I'm Tail Dragger, and this is The Hangar, here on Radio Hangar, broadcasting to you from the busiest airport on the planet this week, right in the middle of the big show at Oshkosh. And I want to talk about a day, a specific day, because this very week back in 1909, one stubborn Frenchman with a burned foot and a 25-horsepower engine climbed into a monoplane made of ash and bicycle wire and pointed it at England. July 25, 1909. 117 years ago, near enough to today that you can feel it. Louis Blériot flew across the English Channel. Now, before I get rolling, let me tell you who's keeping the lights on this morning. Today's show is brought to you by AviationSold.com, aviation challenge coins for every milestone in flight. Your first solo, your private ticket, your instrument rating, your tailwheel endorsement, all the way up. If you've earned it, they've got a coin for it, and I'll tell you, there's something to holding a piece of brass in your hand that says you did the thing. Every coin tells a story. Go have a look at AviationSold.com. All right, let's go back. Picture the summer of 1909. The Wright brothers had flown at Kitty Hawk not quite 6 years earlier. Flying was brand new. It was a carnival act, a rich man's gamble, a way to get yourself killed in front of a crowd. And a newspaper man in London, Lord Northcliffe, who ran the Daily Mail, he understood something about the human heart. He understood that people will chase a prize. So the Daily Mail put up £1,000 sterling, a fortune to the first man to fly a heavier-than-air machine across the English Channel, from France to England or the other way around. Now here's where it gets interesting. The channel doesn't look like much on a map. At its narrowest, near Calais over to Dover, it's about 22 statute miles of open water. You could drive it in half an hour if there were a road, but there's no road. There's cold gray water and fog that rolls in without asking and winds that come up out of nowhere. And if your engine quits, you're swimming, in 1909, with the engines they had. A channel crossing was very nearly suicide, and the man everybody expected to win it wasn't Blériot. It was a fellow named Hubert Latham. Latham flew a beautiful machine called the Antoinette, a graceful monoplane, and Latham was the favorite. On July 19, 6 days before our story, Latham took off from the French coast, got about halfway across, and his engine died on him, right there over the water. He glided down, set that airplane on the channel, as gentle as he could, and was found sitting on the wreckage smoking a cigarette, waiting to be fished out by a French destroyer, cool as you like. But he didn't make it. The prize was still there. Enter Louis Blériot. Blériot was not a young daredevil. He was in his late 30s, a businessman. He'd made real money manufacturing acetylene headlamps for automobiles, the bright carbide lamps that let the early motorcars drive at night, and he took that money, every franc of it, and he poured it into flying machines. He built glider after glider, airplane after airplane, and he crashed most of them. The man was famous for crashing. He broke airplanes the way the rest of us break coffee cups, by some counts. He'd wrecked dozens of aircraft chasing the dream. He was nearly broke doing it, and when he showed up on the French coast that July, he wasn't even healthy. In an earlier flight, the exhaust pipe on one of his machines had scorched his foot, a bad burn, and he was getting around on crutches. Think about that. The man could barely walk, and he's going to fly an open monoplane across an ocean channel. Let me tell you about the airplane, because the airplane matters. It was the Blériot 11, a monoplane, one wing, which itself was daring in an age of biplanes and triplanes. It had a tractor propeller up front, a long open framework of a fuselage behind, and the pilot sat out in the breeze on a little seat with the whole world moving underneath him. For roll control, it didn't have ailerons the way your airplane does. It warped the wing. The pilot pulled cables that literally twisted the trailing edge of the wing up on one side and down on the other, wing warping straight out of the Wright brothers' playbook. And the engine? Oh, the engine, a three-cylinder Anzani, about 25 horsepower on a good day. 25, your lawn tractor may have more than that. It was a rough, hot-running little motor with a reputation for overheating and quitting. That was the power plant that was going to carry a man across 22 miles of cold salt water with no life vest, no radio, and no compass. That's right, no compass. Blériot went across the English Channel by dead reckoning and by eyeball. The morning of July 25th, before dawn, they got him up. The rule said he had to fly between sunrise and sunset, and the weather looked like it might turn, so it was now or never. They carried him out to the machine, this man on crutches, and lifted him into the seat. Somewhere around 4:30 in the morning, first gray light, the Anzani coughed and caught and settled into that hammering, uneven beat those early engines had, and Louis Blériot rolled across the grass at a place called Les Baraques, near Calais, lifted off, made one climbing turn, and pointed the nose at England. Now close your eyes and put yourself in that seat.
You're sitting out in the open. The wind is a wall in your face. The engine is roaring and vibrating right in front of your knees, close enough to touch, throwing back the smell of hot castor oil and exhaust. And that smell is soaking into your clothes and your skin. Underneath your feet, through the gaps in the framework, you can see the coast slide away behind you. And then the coast is gone, just gone, behind you. France has vanished into the haze. Ahead of you, England hasn't shown up yet. There is nothing, water in every direction, gray and cold and moving, and a little wooden airplane humming along maybe 250 feet up, and one man alone in the middle of it with no instruments to tell him a thing. He said later there was a stretch, 10 minutes maybe more, where he could see no land at all, not ahead, not behind. He had no compass, remember. He just held the nose steady, kept the wings level with those warping cables, kept that hammering engine pointed where he thought England ought to be, and he flew, on faith, on feel, on the seat of his pants, which is where all real flying lives. Then and now. And here's the part I love. That temperamental Anzani engine, the one that loved to overheat and quit. It started to run hot out over the water. It was climbing toward the temperature where it would seize up and leave him swimming. And then, Providence, a little rain shower blew across the channel, a patch of cool drizzle. It washed over that engine and brought the temperature back down, and the Anzani kept beating. A rain squall saved his life. You cannot make this up. Then England came out of the haze. The cliffs of Dover, white and enormous, right where they were supposed to be, more or less. But the wind had come up, swirling around those cliffs, and where he'd hoped to land was no good. He came around the back of Dover Castle looking for a spot, fighting that wind, and he found a little green meadow called Northfall Meadow, tucked in near the castle. He chopped the power, he came down hard, too hard. The landing gear collapsed, and the propeller shattered against the English grass. But he was down. He was on English soil. The clock said it had taken him something like 36, 37 minutes to cross. 37 minutes that split history right down the middle, because for 1,000 years England had been an island, protected by that water. The Spanish Armada broke on it. Napoleon stared across it and couldn't cross it. The Royal Navy ruled it, and in ruling it ruled the safety of the whole nation. And a middle-aged Frenchman on crutches in a 25-horsepower monoplane held together with wire flew right over the top of all of it in the time it takes to eat breakfast. The newspapers understood it instantly. There's a famous line from the writer H.G. Wells, who looked at what Blériot had done and understood that England's 1,000-year moat had just evaporated. The island wasn't an island anymore, not the way it used to be. Everything about how nations thought about defense, about distance, about safety, all of it shifted on the morning of July 25, 1909, because one stubborn man wouldn't quit crashing airplanes until he got one that flew. And the airplane itself, the Blériot 11, didn't just make history and retire. It became one of the first genuinely successful production airplanes in the world. Once Blériot crossed that water, everyone wanted his monoplane. Orders poured in. Hundreds were built. Flight schools used them. The early armies bought them and hung them off the front of the first military aviation units. The little machine that crossed the channel became the airplane that taught a whole generation of Europeans what a monoplane could do. The layout he flew that morning, single wing up front, engine on the nose, tail out back, pilot in between, that's the shape of nearly everything we fly today. You can draw a straight line from that seat over the channel to the seat in your Cessna out on the ramp right now. Now, you might be asking Tail Dragger, what does a Frenchman in 1909 have to do with a big fly-in in Wisconsin in the middle of summer? Everything. It has everything to do with it.
Because walk the grounds here at the show. Yes, there are the jets and the glass cockpits and the electric airplanes humming around on the innovation ramp, and I'll grump about some of that another day. But go down into the antique area, down into the vintage rows, and you will find the old ones. The pioneer machines. Wood and wire and linen, cared for by people who understand exactly what they're holding. The Blériot 11 is, to this day, one of the oldest types of airplanes still flying anywhere on Earth. There are original examples over 100 years old that still take to the air on calm mornings, that same warping wing, that same brave little engine. This whole show, this entire gathering, was built by folks who refused to let that heritage rot in a barn. That's what the Experimental Aircraft Association is at its heart. People who believe that an airplane isn't really alive until it flies, and that the story of how we got here, from Blériot's meadow to this flight line,
deserves to be kept running and kept flying, not just kept behind velvet rope. You feel that everywhere you walk here. The reverence. The old and the new parked wingtip to wingtip on the same grass. Every one of those crazy wonderful machines out on the field this week. Every single one owes something to a man who couldn't walk, flying without a compass, save by a rain shower, over the coldest 22 miles in the world. My thanks this morning to the folks at the Smithsonian's National Air and Space Museum, whose accounts of the Blériot crossing keep the details honest, and to the period reporting from the Daily Mail that put up the prize and then wrote the whole thing down for us. If you want the pictures to go with the story, or you just want to see what else we get up to around here, everything lives at radiohangar.com. So next time you fire up that engine and roll out onto the grass, remember the fellow on crutches who did it first over open water with less horsepower than your riding mower and nothing but nerve for an instrument panel. The rest of us have been following his heading ever since. I'm Taildragger. Go fly something.